Good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On The Radar right here on Eagle FM in Namibia. I'm your host, Dafa Happy Juju, and it is great to have you with me as we dive into the stories shaping our country and the wilder world. Now, I'll be bringing you analysis, updates, and perspectives for the next hour and a half. And this right here is your trusted source for the latest news and updates in Namibia and beyond, bringing you breaking developments, in-depth analysis, and the conversations that matter most. Now, every day, decisions are being made that affect how we live, how we work, how we invest, and how we grow as a nation, from governance and economic shifts to innovation, youth development, and private sector expansion. We're here to unpack what's happening and why it matters. Now, through our live broadcasts and digital platforms, On The Radar keeps you connected to real-time updates in politics, in business, in technology, in health, and culture. So wherever you are listening from, whether it's Windhoek, Walvis Bay, Oshakati, Ongodiba, Marienta, Grootfontein, Swakopmund, or anywhere across Namibia, welcome to the conversation. This right here is On The Radar, where information meets insight and where Namibia stays informed. Now let's get right into today's news analysis. Namibia hosted part of the global celebrations marking the 80th anniversary of Ethiopian Airlines and International Women's Day on the 8th of March 2026, with a commemorative event held at the Hosea Kotako International Airport. Now, the event was attended by President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, who addressed guests and officials during the celebrations. Her participation highlighted the importance of the occasion, which brought together aviation stakeholders, government representatives, and airline officials to recognize women's contributions to the aviation sector. Now, the event formed part of a wider global initiative by Ethiopian Airlines to commemorate both 8 decades of operations and the annual observance of International Women's Day. Now, as part of the celebrations, the airline operated 8 flights staffed entirely by women, including pilots, cabin crew, engineers, technicians, dispatchers, and ground staff. The initiative was aimed at highlighting the growing role of women in aviation and encouraging more women to pursue careers in the industry, which is also well known as, or previously was well known as, a male-dominated field. Now, All women operated flights connected Addis Ababa with several destinations across the airline's international network, including Windhoek, Accra, Frankfurt, Mumbai, Nairobi, Cairo, and Dire Dawa. The 8 routes symbolically represent the airline's 8 decades of service, as well as Djibouti. Now, founded in 1945, Ethiopian Airlines began commercial operations in 1946, initially operating a flight between Addis Ababa and Cairo via Asmara. Now, over the years, the airline has grown into Africa's largest aviation group, connecting the continent to destinations across Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and the Americans. Now, the airline has also been promoting gender inclusion in aviation. Women currently make up a significant portion of its workforce across operational, technical, and leadership roles. Now, since 2015, the airline has marked International Women's Day by operating special flights managed entirely by female aviation professionals. Now, the combined celebration of the airline's 80th year legacy and International Women's Day underscores both the growth of African aviation and the increasing role of women in shaping the future of the industry. And right now, let's now take a listen to Ms. Janet Kem, who is the current UN Women Country Representative of Ethiopia, as she spoke at the event.
It is a great pleasure for me to be part of this historic moment. I here as a UN Women Representative in Ethiopia, and International Women's Day is that moment that as UN women, we join hands with government, with private sector, civil society, and the society at large to acknowledge women for the great work they do in nation building, starting from households through communities to our nations. And we are here on the soil of one of the countries where our leader is a woman. Can we give a hand to Her Excellency? I have watched and admired her from a distance, and today it's a great day to have met her in person, and I'm so grateful for this humility to come welcome her daughters that are breaking grounds in aviation. It's really humble. I want to take this opportunity once more to acknowledge the leadership of Ethiopian Airlines for this innovation, for this vision, for this creation. As we all know, aviation has been one of those fields that women were not part of. Not because they couldn't, but because structural and cultural barriers held them behind. It needed a bold organization to start. And I'm happy to hear what is happening even here in Namibia. So the women are taking their rightful place in the aviation field, and we are so happy to celebrate. I want to acknowledge the wonderful crew under Captain Tigist that brought us all the way from Ethiopia to here. Thank you so much. And for the men who are supporting, who are partners, because gender equality is not just about women. And I want to use His Excellency, our first gentleman, ask that example to be here with Her Excellency on International Women's Day, to show us that it's not just a day for women, but a day for all of us, because every home, I think it is Madam Zuma who used to say, women are women and women are everything, because they are half the world and they give birth to the other half of the world. So there is nobody here without a woman, and there is nobody here without a man. So together we form the world. So this Women's Day, we are celebrating justice, rights, and action for every woman and girl. And justice is not only in the courts. Justice is in the workplace. Justice is in the family. Justice is in budgets. Justice is in policies. Justice is in programs. Justice is everywhere. So we are celebrating justice being done by a private sector to promote gender equality, to promote women, and to give women that leadership that they deserve. So as UN Women, I just want to say again, happy International Women's Day. It's a whole month, it's a whole day, it's a whole year, it's a whole time, because every day is Women's Day.
Now, speaking also at the celebration is President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, where she spoke about encouraging women to pursue their desired careers, and that no career is really above in anybody. She also spoke about, she lightly spoke about how she always wanted to be a pilot herself, but nonetheless feels like she has achieved that goal, as she is indeed piloting a whole nation. Let's now take a listen to President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah.
We know Ethiopian Airlines does go to different destinations in the world, but as I have learned, Ethiopian Airlines decided on Namibia to be the focus of the celebration of the International Women's Day by bringing to us this 100% crew. We are proud of you. You are doing it on our behalf, and you have our full support. Welcome to Namibia. Make it your home now and in the future. Yeah. Director of Ceremonies, ladies and gentlemen, more than a century ago, in 1910, women gathered in Copenhagen to demand recognition, equality, and dignity. From that historical gathering emerged what the world now commemorates every year as International Women's Day, first observed in 1911 and later embraced globally as a day to celebrate the achievements of women and renewal of commitment to equality. Today, we commemorate this important day under the theme, as it was mentioned already, Rights, Justice, Action for All Women and Girls. This theme reminds us that progress does not happen by chance. It requires action, determination, and the collective will of societies to ensure that women and girls are given the dignity, opportunity, and space to contribute fully to the development of our world. Ethiopian Airlines is one of those institutions that has given dignity and opportunity to women, and we see the result. Director of Ceremonies, for much of humanity history, women's contribution were often overlooked and undervalued, even though they play a central role in sustaining families, communities, and nations. Through determination and courage, women across the globe gradually expanded the boundaries of opportunities. Today, women lead nations, advance science, shape industries, inspire the next generation in ways that provides generation could follow as they come. Namibia is one of those countries that has made strides in the area of women emancipation. Today, we do not only have the women president, vice president, speaker, secretary general of the ruling party, the deputy chair of the National Council. We have women leaders in business, medical profession, engineers, pilots, both in the civilian and the military side. As it was mentioned already, that when we had our national airlines, we had our women in the crew. They followed the work of the Ethiopian Airlines. It was on Monday the 2nd of this month that the first female judge of the first permanent female judge of the Supreme Court in person of Lady Justice S. Seeming Chase was sworn in Namibia. On behalf of the Namibian people, I congratulate him. Recently, women are excelling in all sectors of human endeavor. Recently, we celebrated the victory of the brave gladiators, the Namibian women national soccer team, who won the COSAFA Cup, won by Namibia for the first time, both by women and men team. It's a progress we are celebrating. As a nation, we must congratulate ourselves while committing to more coordinated efforts to bring about full equality opportunities for men and women in the socio-economic development of our country. It is also important to acknowledge that progress towards equality has been strengthened by visionary men who choose to challenge the traditions of their time. those leaders recognized that societies flourish when women and men stand as equal partners in shaping the future. The late of Julius Mwalimu Kabarak Nyerere, first president of the United Republic of Tanzania, who facilitated the holding of the first conference in 1960 that established the Pan-African Women's Organization, that today is one of the big women organizations in our continent with an observer status at the AU. Namibia, we are proud that the current president of PAU is a Namibian citizen in person of Mem Eunice Ipinge. Director of Ceremonies, today, the 8th of March, not only marks International Women's Day, it's also a day that carries a remarkable moment in aviation history. On this very day in 1910, a French woman named Raymond de Coucher made history by becoming the first woman in the world to receive pilot's license. At the time when aviation itself was still in its infancy, and when the skies were widely considered the prayers of men, she chose to rise above those expectations. By earning that license, she did more than flying an aircraft. She opened the skies for a generation of women who would follow it, and some are in front of us. Today, more than a century later, that spirit continues as Ethiopian Airlines flight ET-835 arrives here in Windhoek, the land of the brave, from Addis Ababa, proudly operated by an all-female crew. What an achievement. What a joyful moment. What an encouragement. Those remarkable women represented the many roles that women now play across the aviation industry. From piloting aircraft to technical operation, and the main responsibility that ensure a safe and successful journey. I wish I could board that plane today. I wish I could. I was going to be smiling for 5 hours in the air, and I will not even feel I'm in the air. Their presence here today sends a powerful message to the young girls everywhere that professions once thought impossible are now within our reach. The sky, quite literally, is no longer the limit. We used to say the sky is the limit. It's no longer the limit. So all the professions are there for us, and we should take a challenge. I have to tell you, I used to say this, and because it's true. As a young person at school, grade standard one and what, when I was asked, what do you want to do? I was always saying, a pilot. A pilot. Where I got it, but you can go and research in those books, a pilot. Of course, I missed it. But no regret. I'm piloting a nation now. So you don't miss your career. I wanted to pilot the plane in the air. But then I feel I'm still piloting a nation. Can you imagine? So no profession is impossible. When it's yours, you can make it. Therefore, today's occasion is made even more special as Ethiopian Airlines celebrates 8 years of service. Over the past 8 decades, the airline has grown to become the largest airline on the African continent to the rest of the world, connecting Africa to the rest of the world and strengthening people-to-people contact, trade, tourism, and cooperation, among others. As a minister of international relations, I've been traveling. And whenever I make connection and I board Ethiopian Airlines, I just feel I have arrived home. I just feel I have arrived home. When you see the African attire, when you see the African smile, when you ask your injera, you get it. You have really arrived home. So thank you very much, Ethiopian Airlines. This remarkable achievement is not only a source of pride for Ethiopia, but for Africa as a whole. Ethiopian Airlines stands as a shining example of African excellence, discipline, and innovation. The 8th administration in Namibia has promised the Namibian people to bring back our national airline. We look forward to learn from the Ethiopian Airline, and we have a strong base as some of the Namibian pilots are trained in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian Airline is part of our history also for independence. When it brought our founding president, His Excellency Comrade Dr. Sam Sefashuna Nujoma, back to Namibia in 1989 after many years in exile. We were honored that the pilot who brought our founding president home, he had an opportunity last year in February to come and be with us as we were sending our founding president off. We thank and congratulate the management and the staff of Ethiopian Airlines for this extraordinary milestone to connect Africa and commend their continued commitment to empowering women within the aviation sector. Director of Ceremonies, as we celebrate the achievements of women, today, Namibia also reaffirms its commitment to ensure that women and girls enjoy the equal rights and opportunities in all spheres of life. Our country has enacted the laws and adopted policies aimed at protecting the rights and dignity of women and promoting gender equality. This includes Combating of Domestic Violence Act, the Affirmative Action Employment Act, and other national policies that seeks to create a society where women and girls can thrive without fear, discrimination, or limitation. Those efforts reflect our firm belief that development of our nation cannot be fully utilized without a meaningful participation of both men and women. To the women who operated this aircraft today, you represent more than a successful flight. You represent the possibilities. You represent progress. And you represent the future that the generations of women who fought tirelessly, their deeds has not gone into vain. Of course, as we are celebrating women achievement, we are cognizant of the need of us also to take care of the boy child, to ensure that they both become responsible citizens in our respective countries and our continent. Your dreams have become true. Your hard work has paid off, and together we must continue to flourish. Together we must continue to serve our nations with dedication, commitment, and loyalty. To all people of the world, men and women, as it was already mentioned here, all of us, we are here because of one another. I therefore say to all of us, Happy International Women's Day, and let us make every day a Women's Day, a Men's Day, and Humanity's Day, where we have to take care of one another for prosperity to be realized in our countries and in our continent. Thank you.
President Ntumanani Daito was speaking at that particular event of International Women's Day and, of course, celebration of Ethiopian Airlines. And one particular aspect I do take away is that she said Namibia will learn from Ethiopia Airlines, and also acknowledge that some of our pilots get to study in Ethiopia. Ethiopia does have a school, or should I say perhaps a university, or maybe it's called a college, where they train pilots, and a lot of pilots from across different parts of the world actually get trained there. Now, if you have ever flown with Ethiopia Airlines, you would really understand how massive this is for Namibia, even to be privileged for that matter to learn from Ethiopia Airlines. And I do believe and do trust that this will definitely come to fruition, considering that Ethiopia decided to come and celebrate International Women's Day and their 80th celebration in Namibia, alongside with President Ntumbonani Ndaitwa and, of course, UN representative in Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopian Airlines is quite massive. I recently had the privilege, and that is last year, to travel with Ethiopia Airlines. And just as we arrived at Addis Ababa International Airport, actually, when we arrived in the evening. It was when we were returning back that I counted all the massive planes that we at that international airport, and I counted over 30 of them. We're talking about those huge planes, like the previous Namibia airline. Was it Air Namibia? Air Namibia. Those big ones. I counted about 30 of them, and that particular point in time, there was only Addis Ababa International Airport, and Ethiopia has other international airports as well. And not only that, they have a college. And not only that, when it comes to security, you have to be really thoroughly scrutinized. You have to go through so many, and it's such a massive international airport, y'all. It's so huge and so efficient, and it accommodates so many people. So a lot of people would be connecting their flights within Ethiopia itself. So you get people coming from South Africa, some coming from United Arab Emirates. You get people coming from so many different places, and then they come and connect their flight within Ethiopia. And then to top it off, they also have their own hotels. I had the privilege to stay in Skylight Hotel, and that's massive, and that's included in your airline ticket, and providing you with a place to sleep over the night and connect the next day, perhaps early morning, with your next flight. So it's something that is really well organized, well structured, and people work there overnight. They're working throughout the day and throughout the night. It's an ongoing shift. I think also another factor that maybe I needs to start looking into, you know, over here, shops close at 7 o'clock. Now, Groupmo, of course, not so many years ago, upgraded to shops closing at 7 o'clock. Before, it used to close at 5 o'clock, which was quite insignificant, because, or was not really productive, because most people are knocking off off at 5 o'clock, should the person actually wants to go shopping, you then limit what's coming in into a business. We might need to actually work in overnight. You know, of course, we're talking about safety, but then those are things that actually be looked at. You know, where there is a way, there is a way. Talking about working companies going up until in the evening. That's also job creation and efficiency and getting the work done. And progressively, as somebody is coming, as those that are going home, others are coming in and the work continues overnight, you know, the people are doing it. And so, yeah, I don't know if another country that probably does it. I'm thinking probably China also does it, but yeah, that's what they do over there in Ethiopia. It doesn't matter what time of the night, even 12 o'clock in the evening, you see cars running in the street. People going to work, people coming back, you know, that type of thing. So when it comes to really Ethiopia Airlines, they are really doing a lot in terms of efficiency, in terms of connecting flights that are connecting so many different countries. They're really doing a lot that Namibia can really learn from. And I just so sure hope that Namibians will take advantage of this opportunity and learn all that needs to be learned in order to get our aviation company up and running and on par with other African countries. Or maybe even to bring it closer to home, such as South Africa managing its international airport, such as the Otambo International Airport. Now, for decades, politics across much of Africa have been largely dominated by men. Now, speaking on International Women's Day, with women often underrepresented in senior decision-making positions. However, recent developments across the continent suggest a gradual shift toward greater female political leaders. And President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah recently made history, that is last year, after becoming the first female president of our country, Namibia. Now, her appointment marked a significant milestone in our country's political history and places Namibia among a small but growing group of African nations that have experienced women at the helm of government. Now, President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah has also assembled a cabinet, as most of us know, those of us listening right here in the land of the brief. But then let's also give out the information necessary for those in the diaspora and also those who have not been to Namibia, but keep on listening to Eagle FM and on the reading news analysis. So President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah has assembled a cabinet in which women occupy a majority of ministerial positions, a development widely viewed by analysts as an important step toward a gender balance in government leadership. Of course, we have the president being a female, and then we have the vice president being a female, and the first also speaker of the National Assembly being a female. We recently had a female added to the parliament, replacing Mr. Dingalo. Let me and speak another correction. Can't really pronounce his name at the particular moment in time. So that's a woman also adding to the already percentage that is there. Now, across the continent, other countries have also seen women rise to prominent political roles. In Tanzania, Samia Suluhu Hassan became president in 2021 following the death of John Magufuli, and that made her the country's first female head of state, although at the time wasn't voted into power, but replaced the president that died. Now, similarly, also Joyce Banda previously assumed the presidency of Malawi in 2012 after the death of President Bingu wa Mutharika. Now, in Ethiopia, Sahel Work Swede became the first country's first female president in 2018. Now, while the Ethiopian presidency is largely ceremonial with executive authority held by the prime minister, her appointment was seen as an important symbolic step toward gender inclusivity in leadership and especially in leadership roles. Now, political analysts do note that President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah belongs to a very small group of African women who have secured the presidency through an electoral process alongside Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the former president of Liberia, who won elections in 2005 and became Africa's first elected female head of state. And from what I've heard, analysts say that Liberia has done really well since it had its first female president, Ellen Johnson. Now, beyond the presidency, women's representation in African parliaments has also increased significantly in recent years. Rwanda is widely recognized as a global leader in women's political representation. Following the 2024 parliamentary elections, women hold about 63 0.8% of seats in the Chamber of Deputies, and that is the highest proportion in the world. Now, advocates say strong female leadership in Rwanda has helped advance reforms on inheritance rights, on family law, and protections against gender-based violence, reinforcing the country's reputation as a leading example of women's participation in governance. And I want to say right here that the one particular angle that perhaps is not really often spoken about, that when women take up leadership roles, they tend to understand the struggles that women generally face that men wouldn't address, because it's not something that they face. It's not a challenge that they face. For instance, an example would be also dressing code. Now, there are some particular women of a certain faith or certain religion who perhaps would want to prefer a hijab, or some of them who don't wear trousers as women. But then when a man is in power, they might not really advocate, they might not at all advocate for such rights. But when a woman is in power, they then make room for such rights to be allowed, and for such inclusivity to be allowed for women. For instance, even certain things such as perhaps a head covering. Certain women wear their head coverings all throughout due to their religious beliefs and faith, and they wouldn't want it to be stripped off for them, off of them, because they're perhaps taking a passport photo in order to get a passport, or perhaps maybe because they have to take a certain media card picture, for instance. So such certain inclusivity are more well adapted, certain reforms are more well reformed when women are sitting in that particular position, because why? They understand what needs that women have, and of course that men wouldn't otherwise address, because it's mostly not in their field. Now, other countries including South Africa, Senegal, Morocco have also introduced gender quota systems aimed at increasing women's representation in political institutions. Now, despite this gains, experts say significant barriers do remain. Women seeking political office often face challenges such as limited access to campaign financing, internal party gatekeeping, and persistent cultural attitudes that associate political leadership with men. Now, public opinion survey conducted by the Afrobarometer shows strong support in several African countries for women's political participation, although social and cultural obstacles do still remain. Like, for example, surveys indicate that 81% of respondents in South Africa and 72% represent in Ghana support equal opportunities for women to be elected to political office. However, many respondents also believe female candidates may face criticism or harassment during campaigns, and also analysts caution that while the election of women to high office represents an important symbolic step, it does not automatically translate into policy changes that improve conditions for women. And that is so very true. Now, structural and institutional barriers within our political systems can still limit the ability of women leaders to implement transformative reforms. Nonetheless, the increasing presence of women in political leadership across the continent is widely viewed as a sign of gradual change. And the combined celebration across Africa, including events marking International Women's Day and milestones, such as the leadership of President Netumbona Nandi-Ndaitwah of Namibia, underscores both the progress made toward gender equality and the continued efforts to expand opportunities for women in sectors such as the aviation sector, politics and leadership, and other sectors also which may seem, which may have been male dominated fields. Women are now taking up their spaces. But of course, I would want to say, as most often some speakers would put it, that it is not that, we give hand over leadership positions to women, but that they would also work hard and end them finding balance as well. Let's pause here for a commercial break.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the member with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, Now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipurane ngeno wapubwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoewe ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko berewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now in other news, the Namibia International Commission on Research, Science and Technology, NCRST, recently launched its research recently launched its research infrastructure survey report, highlighting the country's existing research facilities, gaps, and priority areas for development. Now, the report was represented on 3rd March at the Franco-Namibian Cultural Center in Windhoek, and it provides a comprehensive evaluation of Namibia's research infrastructure, mapping facilities across the country, and assessing institutional capacities. Now, the report aims to guide strategic planning, inform investment decisions, and strengthen coordination in Namibia's research, science, and innovation sector. The NCRST plans to use the report in order to build capacity and promote equitable access to research facilities. Let's take a listen to Professor Dr. Anisha Peters, and she's the CEO of NCRST, also giving a highlight on the report findings. Let's take a listen.
Also mediating throughout our R&D survey, our innovation survey has been stuck in the starting blocks for the past 3 years. There are issues such as respondents being worried about their information being made public. In this case, we see that sometimes they don't want you to know, you know, because maybe it's a competitive advantage that they're having by having certain types of equipment. We also find challenges in terms of the sharing of infrastructure. Sometimes when our researchers approach us, for instance, private institutions, and say that we would like to use that particular piece of equipment, then the answer sometimes comes as no. So I think one of the key questions is then, how do we proceed, right? Because at the same time, we want to be able to see what is existing, what are the gaps, and how do we fill those gaps. But then if we don't have responses, we have to find a different way then of doing our data collection so that we ensure that we capture as much as possible. I think that within the presentation of Mashikongo, you could see how much effort went in. I think you saw that there was an initial attempt on surveying, then there was a lot of secondary data collection, then there was several rounds again cycling back, and she hasn't even captured, you know, how many times we had to go back to go and recapture the information. And when the team was last year ready to sort of say, we are now printing the report and launching it, we said, no, you cannot do that without checking back with everybody, you know, all of the stakeholders and respondents to see whether something had not changed. And I use this example of, for instance, the two universities. I said, imagine that Prof. Colin Stanley and Prof. Mpengekwi and Dr. Safani, sorry, Dr. Ndashio, I'm also acknowledging you, but he's the acting Pro Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation Development at the University of Namibia. So, but I said to them last year, imagine if they are in the room and they're sitting there and they are looking at the book just like you are looking now, and they're saying, no, wait a minute, this information is not correct. You know, we do have X, Y, Z. I said, imagine what's going to happen. So we had to go back and redo the validation, and then we had to go back and check against the SUTCAST database. We had to go back to NSI to say, you know, do you have additional information? I know that TRADE also used to have the a laboratories database. So, you know, so it's constantly checking. And the only way that we can actually overcome this problem is that we must have an online database, because that becomes your repository, so that participants within the ecosystem, Ministry of Agriculture can, for instance, say, okay, I see this is outdated. We've just launched a new facility. We obtained new equipment. Let me update this database. At the same time, Dr. Lupatla has a number, as I indicated, a number of surveys running. But what we are doing now with the help of Auda Nepat is that we're actually training data focal points at various institutions, so that the data focal points themselves can sort of volunteer the data and then upload the data for us, as opposed to us going and sitting, please fill in here, or here's a link for your survey because people are busy, etc. So that's sort of some of the approaches that we are actually taking now. And that the research and experimental development survey is actually ongoing at the moment. I think they just completed with which institution? NUST or UNAS? Okay, so NUST is completed, UNAM is undergoing, but those are not the only two institutions, right? It's everyone who does essentially R&D who's included. So whether you're from public enterprises, from ministries, or from private sector, and even the NGOs are also included. So with this long and windy road, I want to also single out Ms. Lovisa Emmanuel. And I'm extremely happy that she's here this morning. Ms. Emmanuel, please, would you mind standing up? Because we want to sort of applaud you. Ms. Emmanuel is now with the with MISAC, and she's the director responsible for research and innovation, but she was previously the general manager for innovation and technology development at the NCRST, and it's under her guidance and under her ambit that this particular research infrastructure survey had been completed. And then I'd like to ask all of the division, Ms. Shikongo, that's now under her, and her staff to just stand up so that you just see the faces. Maybe you've seen them when they came to you, so that you see the faces of who was really responsible for doing all of this heavy lifting work. And then, of course, all of you for participating and volunteering your data. Now, it is so true that we are sending out so much of our work, right, that we need to do within our own laboratories. We're sending out abroad as well. And NCRST, in our research funding, in fact, we have to make provision, you know, for some of the research work to be conducted in laboratories elsewhere, research laboratories elsewhere, and not in Namibia. So we know the pain of that from Ministry of Trade and International Relations, who raised that point. It's very crucial. We ourselves are busy with accreditation, SATCAS accreditation, for our National Genetically Modified Organisms Lab, that's in Olympia. And with that accreditation process, it is to avoid the situations where we don't send it on a regular basis, but occasionally we have to verify our work and then we have to send it out to laboratories in South Africa, for instance. So we ourselves know the pain of this. And I think, and this is why this particular exercise is so important. So now, this for us is a landmark occasion that signifies substantial progress in Namibia's research journey. It delivers the vital evidence base for the revised national policy on science, technology, and innovation, the second national program of research, science, technology, and innovation that's currently with our ministry, and that NCRST is responsible for, thereby ensuring the strategic allocation of resources towards high-impact development. Within that national program, which is your national research agenda, this entire issue of research facilities and accredited and or certified facilities had been raised to be one of the flagship programs. And you can see now that we are launching this and we're highlighting already the needs, and you can see some of the critical areas. You can also see which regions are neglected in terms of research infrastructure. And this is what we need to try and fill, is to basically target those areas that are so underdeveloped and underrepresented. So I think that this is indeed serving as one of our blueprints. So the report we are launching today represents the culmination of comprehensive multi-stakeholder consultations and strategic synergy between our various government offices, ministries, agencies, public enterprises, academia, research institutions, as well as industry partners. By integrating the unique insights and expertise of these diverse groups, we have moved beyond simple data collection towards a position of strategic clarity. Building upon the technical presentations delivered earlier on the findings and challenges identified, it is evident that this document goes far beyond a simple catalogue of our existing assets. Rather, it provides a vital interpretation of what those assets represent for our future. In essence, the report functions as a high-precision diagnostic instrument and a strategic guide. It moves beyond simply the fundamental mapping of our research infrastructure to provide the analytical depth and strategic direction required to navigate our national innovation and research landscape with greater clarity, coherence, and purposeful intent.
And with that, we pause here now, take a trip to the marketplace. We're back with News Beyond the Borders. Stay tuned.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special angetashia kengeshe fa omarude dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Enough for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa, South Africa and Brazil, speaking about relations on shared values and a clear vision.
All right, so let's quickly come out of that and take you to President Cyril Ramaphosa, who started addressing.
By having this business forum, we have been having a most successful official visit and state visit, really, to Brazil, and we have been well welcomed by His Excellency President Lula and his ministers and various officials, and you too, Vice President Alckmin. So we are eternally grateful to be meeting with captains of industry from both countries, but more especially from Brazil. We are a large and complex and diverse two countries, two democracies. We are two countries that are mineral rich, but more importantly, we are two countries that are full of talent. And as I look around this room, I just see and smell talented people. So all of you are such valued citizens of both our countries. We carry the weight of significant inequality, though. And we both carry the ambition to overcome the legacies of our past. Legacies that were bequeathed to us by colonialism and, in our case, apartheid as well. We have consistently championed the view that the rules governing global trade and investment must be made more fair, more inclusive and more responsive to the challenges that our countries are facing, particularly our countries in the global south. This visit presents us with an opportunity to, in many ways, reimagine a world of opportunities which is anchored by shared values and a clear vision. As Team South Africa, we are keen to rebalance our trade by growing and diversifying South African export or trade with Brazil. President Lula and I, in the morning talks, we bemoaned the fact that the trade between our two countries is at a very low level. The important role that both our countries play on our two continents is far too big to have the trade levels that are so low between our two countries. And the important role that we play as the most industrialized countries on our two continents is far too insignificant to match the standing that we have in our two continents. Both countries have an interest in improving market access and product coverage, as Minister Tau was saying, and we can do that through a variety of offerings. And the Mercosur-SACU preferential trade agreement is a very important platform for us to utilize to good effect, to catapult us to a higher level of trade, which President Lula and I this morning express our displeasure with. Amongst other things, we need to work on reducing trade friction by strengthening cooperation on trade remedies and resolving non-tariff constraints affecting priority products between our two countries. There is huge scope for advancing industrial cooperation in identified high-impact sectors. And between the two countries, there are important key sectors where cooperation can be heightened to a much higher level. These sectors include biofuels, defense, agro-processing, agriculture, aerospace, energy, pharmaceuticals, as well as advanced manufacturing and automotives as well. Now, these cooperation levels should include technology transfer as well as skills development between our two peoples. We want to position South Africa as Brazil's gateway into African markets under the African Continental Free Trade Area, and to position Brazil as South Africa's gateway into Latin America. So the two of us have an opportunity to mutually benefit one another. Many South African companies have operations in Brazil already.
You know, President Ramaphosa and Lula have called for a ceasefire in the Middle East.
A significant moment as key allies, South Africa and Brazil, are meeting as the globe is anxious after the renewed conflict in Iran. The two countries are influential players in the global south as members of IPSA, G20, BRICS and other multilateral bodies. They are very concerned about the situation in the Middle East.
Our visit to Brazil takes place against the backdrop of renewed conflict in the Middle East. We reiterate our call for the peaceful resolution of disputes in line with the United Nations Charter, and we condemn the loss of life, particularly the lives of civilians and the destruction of vital infrastructure in that part of the world.
I told President Ramaphosa of my deep concern with the scaling up of conflict in the Middle East, which represents a serious threat to international security and peace, with wide-reaching economic and humanitarian impacts. These conflicts produce deleterious effects on the energy input and food chains. It is the most vulnerable, above all, children and women who suffer the most severe impact of these crises.
The two leaders are very committed to boost trade between the two giants.
Deepening economic cooperation is imperative, particularly now as the world is faced by tariffs
that seem to be very unfair on a number of countries. We are the two countries that must be trading much more on a much more friendly basis. So South Africa remains committed to strengthening cooperation with Brazil in agriculture, agro-processing, and value-added exports.
Brazil agrees that they need to scale up investments.
We saw that the trade relations is not at the level of the potential that our countries have. The annual exchange between Brazil and South Africa.
Meanwhile, South Africa faces inflation risks amid oil supply challenges.
The U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran will have far-reaching consequences for emerging markets. Already, higher oil prices have changed South Africa's economic trajectory.
The price rise comes through into your inflation number, because we now have a new inflation target of 3% with a 1% leeway either side. We'll breach that 1% leeway, and that would cause the Reserve Bank to possibly be forced to raise interest rates, even though that's not the right thing to do when you have a supply shock, but it might have to do it because it's establishing a new, inflation target.
Brent crude has surged more than 30% year to date and is expected to reach $120 as the war intensifies.
South Africa being the net importer of oil and fuel, we know that most of our refineries have closed down. We don't have enough capacity in terms of refining. Even if we did, we still need oil to be shipped through the Strait of Hormuz, which is almost non-functional. So that is going to have a negative impact. We're going to have to import this oil at a higher price, and also import fuel at the very high price.
Rising oil prices have already started to filter into the South African economy, and it's going to be a double whammy for consumers next month. That's when prices at the pumps will go up and a new fuel levy is set to take effect.
Fuel prices affect every individual. For those commuting with public transport and personal transport, having to fork out an extra cent is quite steep, based on the cost of inflation that we're encountering in the country.
I believe it's going to affect a lot of people, as we know that we are facing actually unemployment. So I believe that we are going to be devastated. But what can we do? But really, it's going to devastate us.
Higher fuel prices feed directly into transport, food and logistic costs, particularly through diesel, placing renewed pressure on households already struggling with elevated living costs.
We're already dealing with higher administered prices in terms of the cost of electricity, because NERSA needs to make an adjustment for some errors that they made a couple of years ago, and the consumer is just going to pay. You've got high food prices already because of the foot and mouth disease. So there's a number of factors that are certainly working against the consumer.
For businesses, especially in agriculture, mining and freight, a diesel spike could erode margins and delay investment decisions.
We are not that far above zero. We have 1.5, like that kind of to 2% kind of like growth targets for the next year. I think $10, oil price increase results in like about a $0.3 reduction in GDP growth. That really puts us into like negative economic growth. So we could be in a recession, and this won't just affect us. Like I said, this will be Europe, this will be the whole world as well.
South Africa, like the rest of the world, is hoping for an end to the hostilities as it remains heavily dependent on a steady oil supply and stable oil prices to maintain economic stability. Sumitra Nadu, CGTN, Johannesburg.
Nigerian motorists also feel the pinch as fuel costs spike nationwide.
The sun rises in Lagos. Teacher Ofolakemi Ofili is already on the road. But before she can get to work, she needs to find fuel. Her morning drive takes her past petrol stations that have run dry. Fuel prices in Nigeria have climbed in recent weeks from about 54 US cents per litre to as high as 93 US cents. The price surge evidently follows the conflict between the United States, Israel, and Iran, which has driven up global crude and freight costs.
I have to get to work. I'm late already. As soon as I know this fuel will get to 1,000, I will have full my tank, and I bought 8.30 by Wednesday last week. I bought 830, and now fuel is 1,000 to 1,003.
Eventually, Ofili finds a station selling petrol, though at a price far higher than what she had paid just days earlier. Nigeria's Dangote Petroleum Refinery said on March 5th that it would prioritize supply to the domestic market following the outbreak of conflict. However, it raised its petrol ex-depot price by roughly 13%.
I pray God intervene in the war so that it will come to an end. So that, because this fuel scarcity or fuel increment now, it will affect everybody. It will make foodstuff to go up, a lot of things will go up, transportation will also go up.
Ofili paid about $14 for petrol, but the amount she receives barely moves the needle on a fuel gauge.
I bought fuel 20,000, and 20,000 is not up to 20 liters, only 19 liters. You can imagine what Nigeria is turning to now. Like before, if I bought fuel 20,000, 20,000 can give me like maybe 25 liters. If you see my tank, the 20,000 naira fuel is not anywhere at all.
According to Nigeria's regulator, Dangote's gasoline supply to the local market recently reached 40.1 million litres. This is just over two-thirds of the country's daily requirement of around 60 million litres. The refinery says it was sourcing additional crude at prevailing international prices, with Nigerian crude grades currently $3 to $6 per barrel, more expensive than Brent. For commuters, rising fuel prices could mean higher transport fares. Bus stops in Lagos are already crowded as passengers rush to board public vans.
If this fuel scarcity passes, if I can't see fuel, I will go to work with public transport. But once I see fuel again this week, maybe by Wednesday, I have to top up like 20 or 30,000 so that I will not experience jumping from one bus to another.
For now, Ofili makes it to work, but she knows the search for fuel is far from over.
I'm at my workplace now. I have to go see another day before I will look for fuel. Maybe Wednesday or Thursday, I will try and look for fuel. I know some filling station will sell during the week.
With prices rising and supplies uneven, many Nigerians are bracing for the possibility that getting to work may soon become even more expensive. Ian Kinyua, CGTN.
Well, let's delve further into the impact on the African continent. And joining us to discuss this is Kennedy Mbeva, a research associate from the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge. Great to have you with us on the show, sir. And I'd like to start off with the economic implications of this conflict and certainly its current impact on key areas such as inflation, supply chains, and also African nations' import bills. How severely have African nations been hit in this area? What's your take?
There's significant concern at the moment about what the implications would be. And we're already seeing a lot of speculation, and that is driving significant economic effects. For example, we can see oil prices going up significantly in different parts of the continent, even though the supply chains haven't been significantly affected yet. So that is driving a lot of concern before the actual economic impacts are hitting the countries. But of course, because fossil fuels or oil is quite a huge part of the economy, for example, in public transport, affecting food commodities, we can see also prices are going significantly up, and that is affecting the consumer sentiment, and people are really concerned about whether they can afford commodities like food, and or also just making their way to work by paying higher and higher transport costs, or even paying for higher fuel costs. But also for governments, there's a lot of concern because for many African governments, they have limited foreign exchange reserves, but they have to use that money to pay for the higher import bill that they are facing over time. And the higher the oil prices go, the more these African countries have to pay in terms of foreign exchange. And that puts them in a very difficult position because they also have to service foreign loans, which they have to use the foreign currency to do so. So you can see already before the actual impacts hit, there's a lot of concern and speculation that is driving up the oil prices, affecting commodities, but also the sentiment of the public on whether they can afford to go to work or move around or even afford food commodities.
And besides the economic impact, is there any concern on the political level? Have there been any significant political effects on Africa so far? And do you expect that we'll see this conflict to have a ripple effect on peace and security on the continent in the longer term?
There could be some political effects very soon down the line, and that's when the concerns about oil prices going really up being a reality of life. When people cannot afford food because the prices have gone up for a sustained period of time, that might be problematic and might bring up issues, for example, protests, taking people to the streets to protest about the high cost of living, including food, but also inflation, where the prices of almost everything goes up. We saw that from COVID, during and after COVID, when the economies were badly hit, and there were protests, especially by young people, about the affordability of commodities. But there's also another bigger political challenge, which has to do with austerity measures. And this is where African governments, when they're struggling to pay their foreign debt, they might have to raise taxes on people. And we've seen such measures are not popular amongst the public. And when you combine inflation with hiking the taxes for people, that would create political problems down the line. And that will most likely instigate protests. But also for governments who might find themselves in a position where they might consider defaulting from paying foreign loans because they do not have the foreign exchange, that might pose a big political problem down the line.
Nonetheless, Nigerian tightens its tax regulations for multinational companies.
Nigeria's tightening its grip on how multinational companies operating in the country calculate their tax obligations. Under the Nigeria Tax Act 2025, royalty payments made by foreign companies to their parent firms abroad will no longer automatically qualify as deductible business expenses. Authorities say the change targets a long-standing practice where companies reduce taxable profits through payments tied to intellectual property, brand licensing, or technical services.
The royalty deduction used to be 5% of their earnings, and that's from the tax law before the NTA 2025. So most of these multinational firms usually shift, you know, the royalty to their related companies outside the country. This new tax law has clearly stated it, that these royalties are no longer going to be allowable deductions.
Under earlier tax rules, multinational firms were allowed to deduct a portion of such payments under Nigeria's transfer pricing regulations. But tax authorities say the system created loopholes that allowed profits generated locally to be transferred abroad while lowering tax liabilities in Nigeria.
It was discovered over time that some companies were using that as a way of reducing, as a tax planning policy, to reduce the amount of tax they're going to pay in Nigeria. Government is trying to now reduce that and make sure that even if you're going to be asking for such deductions, it must be shown clearly that it was actually done as a result of the regular course of doing business.
The reform is part of a broader effort by Nigeria to strengthen domestic revenue collection and align with global efforts to curb corporate tax avoidance. The new rules will particularly affect multinational companies operating in sectors such as oil and gas, telecommunications, mining, and technology.
Nigeria depends heavily on multinational companies across several key industries, but with authorities tightening how cross-border payments are treated for tax purposes, many firms may now need to reassess their tax structures and compliance strategies in the country.
Economists say the move mirrors tax reforms already adopted in several countries aimed at limiting profit shifting by multinational corporations. But the policy could also shape how investors evaluate Nigeria's business environment.
What Nigeria is trying to do is to implement international standard on base erosion and profit shifting. People who are operating within the law want to have fairness, predictability in their dealings with governments.
For now, analysts say the success of the reform will depend on enforcement and how companies adapt to the stricter compliance requirements. Kelechi Amekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
Could countries run out of oil and gas amid the US-Israel war with Iran? Well, let's take a listen to that discussion.
Welcome to BBC Your Voice. It is day 10 of the Iran war, and we're going to spend the next half an hour answering your questions about the energy, oil, prices, the multiple economic impacts this war is having, impacts that are only spiralling. Well, with me here in the studio is our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David. Barbara Plett-Usher is in Doha for us, and Bill Farran-Price also joins us. He leads the gas programme at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. So let's get cracking to Darshini first of all. And the first question, Darshini, it is being asked, how much of the world's oil actually comes from Iran?
And that is a very good question indeed. It is one of the top five producers in the world, one of the biggest with proven reserves as well. But remember, a lot of the West wasn't buying its oil from Iran. So why have we seen such a big price shock on the markets? Much of that oil was going to the likes of China. And what we're talking about here really is the disruption to the region as a whole. So that Strait of Hormuz, that waterway we've heard so much about over the last week, the fact that traffic is practically at a standstill there means that not much is flowing east. And that is causing problems across the region. If you look at Saudi as well, for example, it has said that it's cutting back on production, which is a bit of a blow to the global market because it can't get the oil away fast enough. So that is the problem at the moment. So really, it's not so much a question of where the oil, how much the oil comes from Iran, but frankly, what the wider disruption has been.
Bill, let me bring you in because an opening question to you. We're 10 days into this. Where are we when it comes to the price of crude oil?
Well, we've seen crude bounce much higher since the start of this conflict. This morning, though, it was up a big leg, up as high as $118 for Brent futures. It's come down a fair bit since then, probably on the stories around a potential release of strategic stocks by the International Energy Agency. But prices are still very, very elevated. And that's not just oil, it's oil products as well, refined products, and also gas, because a lot of the world's LNG comes from the Gulf.
Barbara, we're seeing the graphic in terms of the price spike there on the screen. Just in the last 48 hours, even, tell us a little more about the areas, the oil facilities that have been struck.
So Bahrain today, there was an attack on the largest oil refinery in Bahrain. A fire started. That's been brought under control. But the energy company in Bahrain has announced a force majeure, which means it believes it cannot meet its contractual obligations. You've also had in the past 48 hours several waves of drones targeting the largest oil field, or a very large oil field in Saudi Arabia. These have been intercepted. You also had a strike that set alight fuel tankers at Kuwait's international airport. Now, after that, at the airport. After that, Kuwait's energy company announced that it was going to begin to cut back production, also announced force majeure. And on Saturday morning, there was an oil tanker hit in the Gulf. This is what the Iranians said. Of course, you had a number of attacks last week as well in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, and some terminals in the United Arab Emirates where fires started from falling debris.
Darshini, in terms of the consequences, all of that, it is already being passed on at the pump. So take me through the changes we've seen.
Well, indeed, Matthew, this is interesting because when the start of this all happened, beginning of last week, we're all saying this will take days. weeks to feed through to consumers if this is sustained. What we've seen since then is obviously the oil price going further up, and retailers, and this seems to be a pretty much universal thing, being pretty quick to pass these on. So here in the UK, for example, a big motoring organisation, the RAC, is talking about petrol per litre passing 150p per litre, perhaps in the near future. Diesel going over 160 pence, perhaps even higher. A lot of this depends on how fast and how much further we see oil prices going. But this has been a common theme elsewhere as well. In Australia, for example, they've talked about the number of cents going on to a price there and saying, hang on, is this really justified? In the US as well, and let's not forget that in America, gasoline prices, unlike anywhere else, they are the biggest shaper of your thoughts about inflation, right? So this is a hugely politically contentious area. Prices there passing $3 per gallon at the pumps on
average.
Yes,
that's interesting. Without
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dhingi program brought to you by Nalavanda. The Home Ranch with Dwight and Helmut kicks off at 16:30 and the Business Economic segment with David Chamba at 1800 hours. From Indafa, happy Jujutis, goodbye and have yourself a wonderful Tuesday afternoon.